You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Clara O'Donnell. I'm a non-resident fellow at the Centre on the US and Europe at Brookings and a senior fellow at the Centre for European Reform in London. And on behalf of the Centre on the US and Europe, it is my pleasure to welcome you to Brookings for a discussion with First Vice President of the European Commission, Gianni Pittella, on the social impact... Oh, my God, I'm sorry. That's actually what it says in my notes. of the European Parliament, Gianni Pittella, on the social impacts of the Eurozone crisis. I would like to extend a special welcome to Antoine Ripoll and Jean-Luc Robert from the European Parliament Liaison Office with the US Congress, our partner for today's event, and with whom CUSE has had the pleasure of organising several events this year. Over 3 years into the Eurozone crisis, the cost of the economic turmoil on European societies are becoming increasingly apparent. 26 million Europeans are jobless. Youth unemployment in Greece, in Spain, on some accounts, is around 60%. Suicide rates in Greece have gone up by over 35% in 2 years. Governments have fallen. Support for populist political parties is growing. Catalans are calling for independence. And recent EU figures show that trust in EU institutions has plummeted. Between 2007 and 2012, the number of Germans who distrusted the EU has increased from 36 to 59%, while the proportion of Spaniards that distrust the EU has shot up from 23 to 72%. With Europe's stability and prosperity at stake, we are delighted to have the opportunity to host Vice President Pittella to provide his perspectives on the challenges ahead and how the EU and the European Parliament in particular can help address them. Gianni Pittella has been first Vice President of the European Parliament since 2009. He is serving his third term as member of the European Parliament with the Democratic Party. He was twice elected unanimously President of the Italian delegation within the Parliament's Party of European Socialists. And he is the author of numerous books, including A Brief History of the Future of the United States and Europe, which he co-authored with Elido Fazi, and in which they argue that Europe should turn the current crisis into an opportunity and transform the international economic system. In terms of how we will proceed, the Vice President will provide opening remarks, and we will then open up the debate for comments and questions from the floor. Vice President Pittella will make his opening address in English, and in order to provide us with an opportunity to practice our Italian, he will respond to our questions through an interpreter. Vice President, la ringraziamo per essere con noi. We look forward to your thoughts.
Grazie a te e complimenti per il tuo italiano. Non penso che il mio inglese sarà buono come il tuo italiano. E me ne scuso con tutti i presenti. I want to thank you for inviting me today. The Brookings Institution is a world-leading think tank and I am very happy to be here with you today. The social crisis in Southern Europe is a topic which deeply troubles me and also you. I have a long experience as a politician and I think I know a little bit about Southern Europe. I have been a representative of Southern Italy in Italian and European Parliament since the mid-90s. To better describe the situation in Southern Europe, let me start with some data taken from the latest IMF World Economic Outlook. Italy, France, Portugal, Greece and Cyprus are all in recession. They have a current account deficit. The poverty rate and income inequality are also increasing. The unemployment rate is very high and is expected to worsen in 2013. Economic recovery is unlikely to start in 2014. In my opinion, we run the risk that this recession will be the worst in Europe's contemporary history. Beyond this data, the reality is even worse. In my constituency, in south of Italy, I have never seen such a desperate situation. This social crisis will bring about structural changes. Economic changes. Young people are the most affected by this crisis. Southern European governments are also reducing their expenditure in education and research. There is the risk that a new lost generation will grow up. This means that we are losing our potential for growth. Political effects. I am not just talking about political change and alternation. What is at stake today is something much more important. The social crisis is breeding a democratic crisis. The meaning of this democratic crisis is ambiguous. On the one hand, representative democracies are challenged and renewed by a demand for more direct participation in the political process. On the other, this crisis fosters populist movements which undermine democracy. Think about the Greek neo-Nazi movement, Golden Dawn. According to some polls, it may win 20% of voters. 20% for a neo-Nazi movement. To be honest, I am not surprised to see people protesting all around South Europe. I understand why they are afraid. They are worried about our capacity to face this challenge. They are worried about our capacity to give the right answers. They want a clear vision for the future. So, how do we confront this complicated situation? The first answer is clear to me. The European Parliament, in its resolutions, has always been clear. Austerity alone cannot be the answer. Austerity risks condemning Europe to a long period of depression. To reduce sovereign debt, we need growth. Under current trends, growth is too weak to remove imbalances and restore full employment in Southern Europe. The European Parliament called on the European Council to start a real growth program. In 2012, there were some signs of a recovery, weak signs. Under political pressure from the European Parliament, more capital has been granted to the European Investment Bank, and project bonds have been implemented and devoted to major initiatives. The European Parliament is supporting the introduction of euro bonds. I stress this proposal. I support very much this proposal. In order to ease tension in the bond markets, euro bonds should also be devoted to supporting growth by financing long-term projects. Thanks to the European Parliament, the introduction of euro bonds is now more feasible than in the past. With the approval of the two-pack regulations, the European Commission will establish an expert group to reflect on the setting up of a redemption fund and euro bills. The European Redemption Fund will help Eurozone countries in financing their debt backed by joint liability. In exchange, governments will commit themselves to reduce in 20 years the debt over the threshold of 60% of GDP. On the one hand, there will be a pooling of euro debt, and on the other, governments will reduce their debt. Negotiations at the next multiannual financial framework may also be an important opportunity to shape a more ambitious Europe. They will be the real test of the Member States' will to fight the crisis and tackle it together. The current proposal presented by the Council is too weak. It is about 12% lower than the budget first presented by the European Commission. I am sure that the European Parliament will use its veto powers to strengthen the EU budget. The European Union needs an effective federal budget like in the US. The European Central Bank is also underscoring the need for a growth initiative. The two programs launched in 2011 and 2012 have eased tension in the monetary markets, but now we need to be sure that banks will inject more liquidity into the real economy. It is not too late, but we need EU member states to commit to an ambitious plan for growth and jobs. Austerity in Italy is not sustainable anymore. My country has been a leading nation in terms of primary surplus. Except for Norway, no other country in Europe has such a high primary surplus. We have done our best on fiscal policy, but this is not enough. We need to change our economic policy. Austerity alone results in lower GDP growth, lower incomes. This leads to higher government debt. We should follow the American example. First, develop a plan for growth, and only once economic growth has gathered momentum, you can tighten the belt. In Europe, we have done the opposite. We have started with the fiscal consolidation. This recalls the situation in the US in the beginning of the Great Depression, when the government carried out fiscal consolidation too early. Southern Europe is also suffering from a credit crunch. Interest rates are still too high, and the banks are reluctant to lend. Instability in the bond markets and has undermined the banking system, and it is now crucial to sever the link between banks and sovereigns. To address these shortcomings, the European Union, pushed by the Parliament, has put forward a political vision, the banking union. As you know, the banking union is composed of three pillars. One, the deposit guarantee scheme. Second, the recovery and the resolution directive, which we are currently discussing in Parliament, in the Parliament. The Commission is expected to work out a new, more ambitious proposal on this issue by the beginning of the next summer. Third, the single supervisory mechanism, which gives the European Central Bank the duty of supervising European banks, all the European banks. I am confident that the Bundestag will approve the text we have agreed on in February, and the European Parliament will vote it in September. There is also the need to simplify the banking structure of European banks, which is too complex. The Liikanen report and its idea of a ring fencing between deposit bank and the trading entities is an important step in simplifying bank structure and overcoming the too big to fail syndrome. We are waiting for a proposal from the European Commission on this issue. I believe that the banking union and a new growth initiative will be crucial to bring relief to southern European societies. I also believe that to overcome this crisis, we need a strong transatlantic partnership for growth and financial regulation. The transatlantic trade and investment partnership will foster growth on both sides of the Atlantic, and the European Parliament is supporting the launch of the negotiations. The transatlantic partnership may play a crucial role in reshaping the world's economy. We cannot miss this opportunity. For this reason, both the US and the EU have to keep an open mind in the upcoming round of negotiations. There is room to gain for both the EU and the US without compromising our cultural diversity. I know that there are some concerns on issues such as GMO or beef imports, but I am sure that we will be able to focus on what unites us. A new plan for growth, a strong bank union, and the transatlantic partnership will make Europe stronger, but this will not be enough. We should not focus only on macroeconomic issues. In 2007, the US debt was higher than the debt of Spain, Portugal, and France. Today, the US has more debt than the Eurozone, but the Eurozone is under attack. The social crisis in Southern Europe cannot be simply explained in economic terms. It has more to do with the institutional weaknesses of the European Union. This is a confidence crisis. Markets do not believe that a common currency can exist without a common government, and they are right. That's why we need to open discussion on the creation of a true political union. In my book that you mentioned, I wrote this concept, and I hope to open the road to create the political union, the United States of Europe. The next European election will be crucial to shape a political union. We need to open a debate amongst European political parties and the citizens on the future of the European Union. For the first time in the history of Europe, it is likely that the two largest European parties, the European Socialist Party and the European People's Party, will compete for the leadership of the European Commission by presenting their own candidate to the post of president. European political parties will present their platform for the future shape of Europe, and the voters will choose. Political competition among parties with different platforms will foster Europe-wide debate and democratic contestation. This will be the starting point for the creation of a political European Union. Therefore, the next European Parliament elections may be de facto constituent elections. In conclusion, my message is clear. To overcome the most severe crisis since the Second World War, Europe needs to go beyond austerity. But a change in economic policy alone will not be enough. The crisis points out the need for a political union, and I am confident that the next European Parliament will de facto exercise constituent powers. Thank you very much.
Many thanks, Vice President. Before opening up to the floor, I wanted to pick up on two issues. The first one is on this point that you stressed, and that many economists have been stressing, that for the Eurozone to be sustainable in the long term, there will be a need for closer economic and fiscal integration amongst Eurozone countries. Now, although this is being put forward, we notice that there is significant opposition amongst the public opinion in several EU member states to such closer fiscal cooperation. There has been significant opposition to EU bailouts in Germany, Finland, France, the United Kingdom. On recent EU figures, in autumn of 2012, in Germany, only 26% of people supported the idea of Eurobonds. Now, in light of these realities, how can European politicians move forward? How can they convince the electorate to take this step forward towards closer economic integration and political integration? And if we do not, where do you see Europe's future 5 years from now?
Grazie. Io so bene che nell'opinione pubblica, soprattutto nel Nord Europa, in questo momento è forte la tentazione di fare da soli, di trascurare e dimenticare quel principio fondante dell'Unione Europea che è il principio della solidarietà. ma credo che questo sia un grave errore, che si ripercuoterebbe contro le stesse nazioni del Nord Europa.
Thank you. I am well aware that, especially in the northern EU countries, there is this tendency to want to go at it alone, forgetting one of the underlying principles of the European Union, which is the principle of solidarity. And I'm personally convinced that if they do abandon this principle of solidarity, then they would actually find themselves in more dire straits.
C'è una bella frase che dice: la Germania ha perso tutte le guerre, ma ha vinto tutte le paci.
There's a very nice saying that goes: Germany lost all the wars, but has won all the peace.
Che cosa voglio dire? Voglio dire che la Germania è una delle nazioni che si è più giovata della costruzione dell'Unione Europea, dell'integrazione europea.
And by this I mean to say that Germany has been definitely one of the countries that most has gained from the European construction and the European unification idea.
E anche in termini di economia e di utilità, di convenienza per le imprese tedesche, il mercato europeo costituisce il 60% del mercato dove si collocano i prodotti tedeschi.
Even in just simple economic terms, for the growth of the German industries and companies, European market accounts for 60% of German exports.
Dunque, rimettere in sesto il Sud Europa è cosa che conviene agli stessi popoli e agli stessi governi del Nord Europa. Per rimettere in sesto il Sud Europa è necessario fare due operazioni: fermare la politica di austerità, allentare e anche sul piano temporale diluire la politica di austerità, e la seconda operazione da fare è costruire una governance adeguata alla moneta unica che noi abbiamo. Non può reggere una moneta senza Stato.
And so bringing the south of Europe back on its feet, it's something that ultimately will benefit all the countries of the northern part of the European Union. So we have to bring the countries of southern Europe back on their feet. And to do this, there are two things that must be done. First of all, you have to stop austerity as is now. We have to loosen it or dilute it more over time. And the second thing that needs to be done is to build a good governance for the single currency, because you cannot have a currency if you do not have a state that governs it.
Io mi auguro che dopo le elezioni tedesche in settembre si possa creare un clima politico più positivo, nel quale si possa siglare un compromesso chiaro con la signora Merkel.
And I really hope that following the German elections in September, we will be able to find a more positive political climate that will allow us to sign a clear compromise with Mrs. Merkel.
Con tre punti. Il primo punto è: la fedeltà di bilancio non è in discussione, c'è bisogno di maggiore flessibilità per traguardare gli obiettivi di bilancio che ci siamo prefissi. Secondo punto: bisogna incrementare la crescita e l'occupazione, far respirare l'economia europea e dare una risposta alla crisi sociale. Terzo punto: apriamo insieme il cantiere per gli Stati Uniti d'Europa, a cominciare dalla elezione diretta del Presidente della Commissione Europea.
And this sort of compromise that we should be undersigning together should be composed of three main elements. First of all, we have the fact that everybody must respect a certain budget rigor is not even in discussion. That's pretty obvious. But you need more flexibility so that we would be more able to reach those budget goals that we all agree. Secondly, you have to foster growth and jobs. We need more breathing room in Europe to overcome this social crisis. And thirdly, we should really open the way to discuss the creation of a United States of Europe. And this might begin by choosing together the President of the European Commission.
By the citizens.
Directly chosen by the citizens.
Thank you. Another question before turning it over, and that is on the United Kingdom. You mention in your book on a brief history of the future of the United States of Europe, you discuss the possibility of the United Kingdom leaving the EU, and you argue that not only should the UK remain, but it should even join the euro. I was wondering if you could offer your thoughts on what you would see as the main costs that the UK would incur if it did indeed leave the EU, and what shortcomings would it be, or what costs would the EU itself incur if the UK were to leave?
Ma innanzitutto io vorrei dire agli amici britannici che l'Europa non era alla carte, nel senso che tu vai al ristorante e puoi scegliere. Io prendo l'antipasto, oppure prendo il secondo, oppure prendo soltanto una bella insalata di frutta. L'Europa è una comunità di destino. Se stai nella comunità di destino, devi prendere il buono, il meno buono o finanche il cattivo. Altrimenti, come dire, non è corretto stare per ciò che ti interessa e stare per ciò che non ti interessa. Questo chiarimento va fatto. Detto questo, io sono favorevolissimo a che il Regno Unito rimanga nell'Unione Europea, anzi, che aumenti la sua presenza nell'ambito di quelle politiche che in questo momento vedono fuori il Regno Unito. Perché per noi è interessante, è utile la presenza. E dico anche, state attenti, perché oggi nella City di Londra, che rappresenta una componente importantissima del PIL del Regno Unito, le operazioni si fanno in euro e una, diciamo, uscita dall'Unione Europea potrebbe compromettere questo vantaggio che ha in termini finanziari il Regno Unito.
Well, first of all, one thing needs to be made very clear to my British friends. Being in Europe, it's not like going to a restaurant where you ask for the menu and I can decide to have a starter. You might pick a main course and someone else will have a fruit salad instead, okay? The EU is a common destiny choice. And when you're in a common destiny choice, you take the good with the bad. You're in it for better or for worse. You cannot just join for the things that you like and interest you and just sort of say, well, I just won't be part of that because I don't like that bit. You can't do that. And so having made that perfectly clear, I would also like to stress that I would really like the UK to stay in the EU. In fact, I would like them to increase their presence and weight in the EU, especially in those areas of policy where they're currently opting out and their voice isn't heard. And let me give them a warning as well, because the City of London, whose financial transactions bear a significant weight on the country's GDP, operates in euros. And this euro transaction has been incredibly beneficial to the UK. So they risk losing out that as well.
Grazie. Indeed. We will now turn it to the floor. We will group several interventions together, and I would be grateful if you could wait for the microphone and introduce yourselves. Yes, gentlemen, over here.
Bene, fermo.
Sei bravissimo. Okay. I found the analysis that you made quite convincing, and also the follow-up, what you suggested. I was not convinced, however, by your outlook and hope how the better growth and growing together could be achieved. It is no question that austerity alone will not produce growth. This has been said now for several years. There's no surprise.
It's good that the representative of the parliament believes that also. So there will be no growth without measures that the enterprises will take, individuals will take. The fact that you did not mention solidarity, which has been playing such an important part in this debt crisis, was a little bit surprising to me. I mean, the union has been functioning well. The members of the union have provided financial support to manage the debt crisis. The facts, the measures that you listed there, banking union, joint bonds, and all other kinds of things, they are not going to produce growth. They are instruments to manage the debt problem. When you say that we need to create growth, let's remind ourselves, governments, EU institutions cannot do that. It has to come from entrepreneurs who invest, provided by funds from the banking sector. I don't really see how you could hope that bureaucratic measures could produce growth in Europe when for several years now growth has been lacking in key countries all over Europe, and the unemployment figures are certainly not only a result of the austerity measures, but also of the lack of growth previous to the measures. And last but not least, when you say that we need a political union, that we need a government that goes with this currency, I think nobody could disagree with that. But this discussion has been going on for 40, 50 years in detail, intensively. Why would you think that now, in this crisis situation, governments would be willing to resume this discussion when to get over the next year, over the next 2 years, is much, much more important than create a future Europe?
Okay, and so if you could introduce yourself, please.
Ulrich Hever is my name.
Thank you. Yes, we'll take some other points. Yes, the gentleman in the red shirt, thank you.
Well, I'm coming from a very small European country, Croatia, that is going to join the EU on 1st of July. So I would like to congratulate to the presenter, but I would also like to express my view on the crisis. Economic, financial, and debt crisis in Europe are becoming cultural crises. For example, in my language, there is no term for austerity. So there are two types of European countries. Austerity countries that are mostly, unfortunately, fortunately, Protestant ones, and hedonistic countries. These are Mediterranean or southern country or Balkan countries, and it is going to be very difficult to find consensus on economic policy. And I agree with the thesis on a useless discussion on political union in the times of crisis. Thank you.
We'll start with these two.
Facciamo tre.
No? Ah, voglio tre? Sì, sì, va bene. I think, yes, sir.
Ah,
Richard Shin with Economist Incorporated. Yesterday at Brookings, chief economist at the World Bank, Dr. Basu, I think, said that, you know, the world needs more macroeconomic coordination among industrialized nations, and two, that the liquidity that's been provided up to this point has been more financial, but that should be targeted toward more labor-intensive industries or labor-intensive firms. So your recommendations seems to be targeted to those, correspond well with those policy recommendations, having a political union that's gonna, and an economic union, and as well as, you know, advancing more growth-oriented types of policies. So my question here is that, one, given the different incentive each country has, how could we reach a consensus, as previous questioners had asked? And two, the type of political union that you're discussing, the United States of Europe, is that more like the United States of America model, where states have some amount of autonomy, but most of the power is concentrated in the federal government? Or, you know, for example, what would you do with the military? You know, is military going to be consolidated, or is it going to be remain with individual countries? So could you provide a little bit more detail on your vision?
Allora. Non è vero che io non ho parlato di solidarietà. Rispondendo alla prima domanda sua, ho detto che l'Unione Europea si è fondata sul principio della solidarietà.
It's not true that I haven't mentioned solidarity. When I answered the first question, what I said was that solidarity was the underpinning principle of the European Union.
E sul principio di solidarietà noi dobbiamo fondare il superamento dell'attuale crisi.
And we have to use the principle of solidarity which underpins the union as a building block to overcome the crisis.
La verità è che negli ultimi anni l'Europa ha, non dico smarrito, ma diluito la sua funzione civilizzatrice. E questo è la ragione più importante della sua crisi. La crisi europea è una crisi di senso. È diventata l'Europa dei tecnocrati, della tecnocrazia, dei mercanti e dei mercati, della finanza e delle grandi operazioni finanziarie, ed è sempre di meno diventata l'Europa della solidarietà, del riconoscimento reciproco, dello stare insieme, del convivere insieme, pur essendo una somma grande di culture e di identità diverse.
And I think that over the past few years we've lost a bit sight of what Europe should mean in a way, and Europe has become more a Europe of technocrats, a Europe of markets and marketeers, a Europe of big financial operations, losing sight of what it was supposed to be, and it's become less a Europe of solidarity, a Europe of mutual recognition, a Europe where you could be together and you live together, even though we really are a sum of very, very different cultures and a wide range of diversities.
Io non sono convinto che la crescita può venire soltanto attraverso il ruolo dei privati. Il ruolo dei privati sicuramente è importante per determinare la crescita e la produzione di lavoro, ma penso anche che ci sia un ruolo del pubblico, delle autorità pubbliche, sia le autorità nazionali che le autorità europee. E da questo punto di vista io penso che in un momento di crisi ci sia bisogno di
misure anticicliche, cioè ci sia bisogno di maggiori investimenti pubblici. Noi abbiamo prioritariamente necessità di un piano europeo di investimenti da 1.000 miliardi di euro all'anno su ricerca, formazione, educazione, energia, reti infrastrutturali, reti telematiche, Erasmus universale per tutti i giovani dai 16 ai 35 anni, sostegno alla piccola e media impresa, che non può essere lasciata a se stessa nel creare posti di lavoro e nel creare ricchezza. Per fare questo ci sono due strade. Prima strada è togliere dal calcolo del patto di stabilità le spese per investimento. Seconda strada, lanciare gli eurobond. Gli eurobond sono titoli di debito che possono essere messi a livello europeo e raccogliere una provvista finanziaria di 3.000 miliardi all'anno, di cui 2.000 da utilizzare per ridurre il debito e 1.000 da utilizzare per finanziare un piano europeo per la crescita e la coesione. Se non fa questo, l'Europa rischia di diventare l'area marginale del mondo.
Well, I don't agree when you say that growth only comes through the private sector initiatives. Yes, the private sector is really, really important, but it cannot go at it alone. I think in this type of crisis, we also need an institutional and public support. In this kind of crisis, you need to increase the public monies that are spent in investment. And so we need a European investment plan of 1,000 billion euros to spend on research, to spend on training, to spend on education, on energy and infrastructural networks, on telematic networks, on a universal Erasmus for all young people between the ages of 16 and 35, on the SMEs, because the SMEs are vital, but they cannot be left alone to pick up the pieces and try to rebuild everything. And I see this being achieved in two ways, using two tools, if you like. One is that the Stability Pact should not comprise investment expenditures. And the second thing is the use of Eurobonds, which are securities that can be made available throughout Europe, and to the tune of 3,000 billions a year, 2,000 of which should be employed to reduce the country's debt, and 1,000 billion of which should be used to promote growth. Because if we don't do something like this, then Europe risks being marginalized in this global economy.
E questo studio sulla potenzialità degli Euro Union Bond non è uno studio mio, e non sono un economista, ma è uno studio fatto da due illustri economisti che si chiamano Alberto Quadro Curzio e Romano Prodi.
And I haven't come up with this idea of the Eurobonds on my own. I'm not an economist, so this report was published by two important economists, very well respected economists, Alberto Quadro Curzio and Romano Prodi.
Sono d'accordo con il signore che ha parlato per quanto riguarda il ritardo accumulato nella costruzione dell'unione politica. L'errore che è stato fatto è stato di pensare che bisognava fare il tetto era la moneta. Fatto il tetto, si sarebbero fatti poi i pilastri, e fatti i pilastri si sarebbero fatte le fondamenta, cioè l'unione politica, la governance economica e fiscale. Invece si è fatto il tetto e i pilastri e le fondamenta mancano. Che cosa mi fa pensare che la classe politica e i governanti vogliono andare avanti in questa direzione? Una considerazione molto, molto semplice. La moneta così come è oggi non può rimanere senza avere un'armatura di governance economica, fiscale e politica. Dunque, o c'è la disintegrazione dell'euro e la disintegrazione dell'Europa, oppure c'è una strada che ci porta verso il governo europeo dell'economia, delle politiche fiscali e il governo politico dell'Europa.
But I agree with you when you remark that we've wasted a lot of time in Europe. We've been discussing these things for decades. And why do I think that now perhaps the politicians have changed their minds? Well, I think that the reason why we've accumulated all this sort of backlog was that we started thinking things the wrong way around. We started with the roof, which was the common currency. And then we thought, well, once we have a roof, we'll get the pillars. And once we get the pillars, we'll set in the foundations. The foundations being the political union, a common economic and fiscal policy. And the reason why I think that things have come to a head now and perhaps the political class and politicians might be more willing to change their mindset and contemplate a political union is that we are all realizing that the euro as such cannot continue without a common economic policy, fiscal policy, and this leads to a political communality. And so I think that there is the hope that we might achieve a common economic policy, fiscal policy, and ultimately a political union.
All'amico della Croazia dico innanzitutto auguri per l'ingresso della Croazia nell'Unione Europea e per la presenza dei colleghi croati nel Parlamento Europeo. Io non penso che non ci sia la possibilità di tenere insieme il calvinismo del nord e, diciamo così, maggiore sciovinismo, una maggiore apertura da parte dei paesi del sud dell'Europa. Le tradizioni culturali diverse, anche il modo di intendere il rigore di bilancio, la spesa pubblica, sono una ricchezza. Io considero questa diversità una ricchezza. Si tratta di trovare dei punti di compromesso. Quando io dico alla signora Merkel facciamo un compromesso, lo dico sapendo che c'è un'esigenza di fedeltà di bilancio e c'è un'esigenza di aiutare i paesi dell'Europa del Mediterraneo a venire fuori dalla situazione di grandissima, drammatica crisi sociale ed economica. Si può fare insieme se non c'è una concezione draconiana, dogmatica, quasi ideologica, se si superano i dogmatismi e gli ideologismi. Noi possiamo trovare un punto di congiunzione, di compromesso pratico, laico, tra lo spirito e l'anima nordica e lo spirito e l'anima mediterranea dell'Europa.
But to our Croatian friend, first of all, let me say good luck and well done for joining in July and for having members of the European Parliament. And I would say that it's not such a problem, really, putting together and having them work together the sort of more Calvinist, austere spirit of the northern European countries with the more hedonistic approach of the southern European countries. Yes, there might be different ways of interpreting what it means to respect a budget, But I think in the end, it's not irreconcilable differences. In fact, I believe that these cultural differences and these different mindsets are a richness that we have, not so much a problem. And when I say, you have to come to find the commonalities upon which you build a compromise. So when I say we would like to sign a compromise with Chancellor Merkel, I mean that, yes, we have to, both sides have to step away perhaps from their more dogmatic, idealistic almost, draconian way of seeing things, finding a more common ground. And in this way, I'm sure we can find pragmatic meeting points on which we can build something, because if we do not have the means to solve this terrible social crisis in the south of Europe, the whole thing is going to come apart.
L'ultima risposta riguarda che tipo di unione politica io intendo. Io sono molto pratico e anche gradualista. La prima cosa che dobbiamo fare è il lancio delle candidature per la presidenza della Commissione europea. Già da ora il Partito Socialista Europeo può lanciare la candidatura di una sua personalità, io penso, è una mia idea, all'attuale Presidente del Parlamento Europeo, l'onorevole Martin Schulz, come uno dei candidati di maggiore prestigio del campo socialista. Dall'altra parte, il campo popolare dei cristiano-democratici può pensare ad una candidatura altrettanto prestigiosa. Poi ci sarà il candidato dei liberal-democratici o dei Verdi. Questi candidati possono essere presentati con, devono essere presentati con delle piattaforme programmatiche e politiche, e i cittadini che voteranno il 25 maggio del 2014 dovranno poter dire: io voto quel partito, quella lista, perché è collegata a questo candidato alla presidenza della Commissione europea. Dopodiché penso che il nuovo Parlamento che sarà eletto dovrà avere una funzione costituente, cioè disegnare la nuova Europa politica. Nella nuova Europa politica io penso che debbano esserci due camere legislative, la Camera Legislativa del Parlamento e la Camera Legislativa del Consiglio Europeo, quindi rappresentando i cittadini come Parlamento e gli Stati attraverso i governi del Consiglio europeo. Penso che ci debba essere un vero ministro degli esteri che possa fare una politica comune nel mondo. Penso che ci debba essere un ministro del tesoro europeo. Penso che ci debba essere una banca centrale europea che sia esattamente com'è oggi la Federal Reserve, quindi prestatrice di ultima istanza, e penso che ci debba essere un bilancio europeo come il vostro bilancio federale, e penso che ci debba essere una politica comune sulla difesa e la sicurezza, un esercito europeo. Questi sono i lineamenti di quella che io definisco l'Europa politica, o per meglio dire gli Stati Uniti d'Europa.
To answer the question, what do I mean and how do I see this United States of Europe? Well, I consider myself a pragmatist and somebody who likes to do things step by step. So, should start by having the candidatures for the post of President of the European Commission. The European Socialist Group is going to present their candidate. Personally, I think it might be the current European Parliament's president, Mr. Martin Schulz, who is a very well-known figure in the socialist European parties, and I think that the European People's Party might come up with an equally illustrious and well-known candidate, and so should probably will the Liberals and the Greens and so forth. But the important thing is that each candidate should clearly present his or her political platform so that the citizens, when they go and vote at the European elections on May 25th, 2014, will be able to say, I'm voting for this party because this is their candidate and this is what they want for Europe. That would be the first step. The second step, on the other hand, would be for the newly elected then European Parliament after, at the 2014 elections to play a real constituent role, to create a new political Europe. I would like to see two legislative houses in the European Union. The European Parliament, which would be directly elected, which is directly elected by the citizens and therefore would represent the voice of the European citizens, and the European Council, where the voice of the individual member states can be heard. And I would like to see a true single European foreign minister. I would like to see instituted the figure of a true single European treasury minister, as well as I would like to see the European Central Bank be like the Federal Reserve and be able to become the lender of last resort. And I would like the European budget to be set up like the US budget, so with a part that pertains to the single states and an oversight that belongs to the federal authority. And I would really like for our defense and security policy to become truly common, and yes, a single European army. This is my personal vision of a United States of Europe.
Thank you. Next round of questions. Yes, here. The gentleman here, thank you.
I'm Nicola Vera from the Embassy of Italy, but I'm speaking on a personal capacity, of course. I wanted to dovetail on one of the previous questions concerning the divide between North and South Europe. I think one of the most urgent things in the euro crisis is to set the narrative straight on the root causes of the crisis and on the reasons of the present situation. On the root causes, the conventional wisdom goes more or less, oh, the crisis has been caused by the profligacy of some government. This is not true. Plainly, it's not the case. Maybe it was partially true for Greece, but there was no such thing as profligacy in the other countries. It was not the case, definitely not the case in Spain and Ireland. It was not the case in Italy, which, as President Pittella said, run a huge primary surplus for 10 years or so. And it was not even the case in Portugal. So the crisis has been mainly created in the banking sector. Of course, we cannot dwell on that now, but it's not definitely not a crisis caused by the profligacy of southern government. This as far as the root causes are concerned. As far as the present situation is concerned, the usual conventional wisdom says the individual member states should regain the confidence of the markets. Also in this case, it's partially true, but it's not the whole truth. There is, of course, the need to redress some budget imbalances, but one of the reasons why the markets ask such high interest rates, for example, in several member states, is the fact that they consider them as the deficit countries as being indebted in a foreign currency because they don't have the printing press, they don't have a an economic government and so on and so forth. That's one of the reasons why. So there is a national reason, but there is also a European reason. It has been very difficult to fight this narrative that leads inevitably to the austerity, because if the problem was the profligacy of a government, then the solution is austerity. As President Pittella correctly said, we should probably change the framework, also the narrative. But this has proven to be very, very difficult. Now, my question is, probably what we really badly need is an authentic European political debate. And what can the European Parliament, which is par excellence the forum where this political debate can take place, what can the European Parliament do, and what can the European political parties do to encourage an open, frank, and constructive collective debate on this, on those issues?
Thank you. Yes, Brian.
Brian Beery, Washington correspondent for Europolitics. I have a very specific question on the upcoming negotiations for the free trade agreement with the EU and US. What is your view about the scope for what those negotiations should cover? The French government has said clearly they do not want the audiovisual sector covered because it's part of the Europe's cultural exception. Do you agree with that position? And what do you think, as an Italian member of parliament, are going to be the sensitive issues, the issues that Italians care most about in these negotiations?
Thank you. We'll take one last question, sir, here.
Thank you. Alex Brute here with ASCGS at Johns Hopkins. Mr. Pittella, it's not hard to agree with most of what you say in terms of some of the things that need to be done long term, and also the fact that, of course, sort of synchronized austerity is making the situation, the economic situation in most of Europe worse. But one point that you have not addressed at all in your presentation is the need for some of these countries, specifically the countries in the periphery, to address some of its some of their structural weaknesses that have accumulated over the past 10 years, something that, of course, cannot happen overnight, but you haven't mentioned at all. Do you think that these economies would find a path back to growth, and it would be sufficient to basically boost public expenditure in a sort of Keynesian way, or do you actually see that some of these countries, and specifically Italy, has a backlog of reforms that have not been implemented in the past 10 years that have made the country less competitive within Europe, but definitely less competitive at a global level? Thank you.
Thank you.
Next round. Del dottor Verola condivido ovviamente l'analisi che ha fatto totalmente, pienamente, e rispondo soltanto alla sua domanda: che cosa possono fare il Parlamento europeo e dico anche la Commissione europea per lanciare un grande dibattito su questi temi e per preparare adeguatamente le elezioni europee del 2014? C'è stata già una proposta della commissaria Reding che chiede ai partiti politici europei di indicare dei candidati e dei programmi politici per la prossima presidenza della Commissione europea. Questo, secondo me, è uno degli aspetti più importanti, perché se noi apriamo da oggi il dibattito nelle opinioni pubbliche nazionali su questo punto, qual è il programma del singolo candidato alla guida della Commissione europea nel 2014? Qual è l'Europa che questo candidato vuole portare avanti? Noi riusciremo in questo modo a convogliare l'attenzione su questi temi. Se non faremo questo, il dibattito dei nostri singoli paesi sarà tutto dirottato sulle questioni domestiche e egemonizzato da una posizione strumentale e demagogica di chi attribuirà tutte le colpe dello stato di cose che non va all'Europa, e ciò incrementerà in maniera abnorme i movimenti anti-europei, i movimenti xenofobi, i movimenti razzistici, che pure ci sono e che rischiano di portare nel prossimo Parlamento europeo una rappresentanza sia a destra che a sinistra molto forte.
Well, of course I agree completely with Mr. Verola's assessment of the situation and the picture and the message. So I will just limit myself to answering his question. So what can the European Parliament do? And I would add also the European Commission, actually, to start this great debate on the future of Europe, and especially to prepare the elections at the European Parliament in 2014. Well, Commissioner Reding has already put it out there. She has asked the political parties to come up with a candidate with a clear political manifesto, and so for the next commission and president. And I think that this is a very important starting point. We have to have the citizens be able to identify candidates who say, okay, this is my position, this is what I think Europe should look like in the future. And therefore, when the citizens go vote, they will go and vote for that candidate because it proposes that future. And in this way, we can focus attention back on the actual political idea and the idea of that particular Europe. If we don't do that, the risk is that the focus of the discussions, as usual, will come back to the single member states and will focus on domestic ills and woes, and this will be taken over by the more demagogical factions who will say, well, everything that's wrong with our country is the fault of Europe, and we will see a rise in more anti-European movements, xenophobic movements, and the risk is that the next European Parliament legislature will have an increase in seats, both left and right, taken over by these sort of extreme movements.
Sull'accordo da fare sul commercio, la partnership tra Unione Europea e Stati Uniti, io considero che questo sia un'opportunità grandissima che noi non dobbiamo perdere e che porterà vantaggi economici e politici ad entrambe le sponde dell'Atlantico. Solo per dare un dato, sul piano economico l'Italia, per parlare solo del mio paese, beneficerebbe dall'accordo sul libero scambio, sul commercio, di un incremento in termini assoluti per il PIL di 4 miliardi in 10 anni, con un incremento dallo 0,5 all'1% per anno del PIL. Ma al netto di ciò, quindi del vantaggio economico, c'è anche un straordinario vantaggio politico. Attraverso l'accordo l'Europa riguadagna una sua centralità nell'interlocuzione con gli Stati Uniti d'America, e questo è fondamentale. Detto questo, poiché il Parlamento europeo voterà il suo mandato per iniziare il negoziato nella prossima plenaria di Strasburgo, io non voglio anticipare quale sarà limiti del mandato stesso, quindi del campo di applicazione che noi pensiamo debba avere. Personalmente io non ho pregiudiziali, fermo restando che poi si tratterà durante il negoziato di capire quali possono essere i punti di compromesso, ma personalmente io non ho pregiudiziali rispetto a settori, pur nella consapevolezza che vi sono delle preoccupazioni che dovranno essere rassicurate e che riguardano i cibi, che riguardano quindi l'alimentazione, il settore agroalimentare, che riguardano gli OGM e che riguardano le diversità culturali.
Coming to the question of the upcoming negotiations on a US-EU free trade agreement, I completely subscribe to it. I think it is hugely important. This is a hugely important opportunity that we must not miss out on. And it will bring advantages both in political terms and in economic terms. I mean, to give you just a small example from my country alone, Italy stands to gain from this treaty about 4 billion over 10 years in terms of GDP increase at a rate that varies between 0.5 and 1% per annum. But besides the economic advantages, there are also huge political advantages to be gained because, and this is very important for us Europeans, Europe would be once again a central interlocutor for the US on the global stage. And the European Parliament at the next plenary in Strasbourg is going to vote on the negotiation mandate to start talks on this treaty. And so I cannot really say what the scope or limits on this scope will be as agreed upon by this mandate voted by the Parliament. Personally, I don't have any prejudice on any of the sectors that should be or not encompassed. I know that we will have to find some position of compromise on one or the other, and I know that there are some areas of more concern, mainly food, agribusiness, GMOs, and the cultural differences.
L'ultima risposta riguarda, se ho capito bene, le carenze strutturali negli Stati membri, cioè la mancanza di riforme strutturali in alcuni Stati membri. Ora, siamo chiari, non è esattamente vero che gli Stati dell'Europa del Sud non hanno fatto riforme strutturali. Perfino l'Italia in parte le ha fatte. E poi ci sono altri Stati che sono sottoposti ai programmi di salvataggio che come condizionalità hanno la realizzazione di programmi di riforme strutturali. Quindi non è che dobbiamo dire che esistono i virtuosi del nord e i peccatori del sud, perché questa è una visione manichea e non falsa. Allora, che l'Italia debba fare ancora riforme strutturali, io non lo nego, ma non diciamo che non ha fatto nulla in questi anni, perché non è vero, deve andare avanti. Ma non ci illudiamo che soltanto attraverso riforme strutturali noi risolviamo il problema della ripresa economica, della ripresa, del recupero di competitività e di coesione. È una illusione pericolosissima. C'è bisogno di adeguare le legislazioni in materia di mercato del lavoro? Discutiamone, senza importare modelli che puntino alla precarizzazione. Una cosa è la flessibilità e una cosa è la precarietà. così come io penso che bisogna andare avanti in alcuni settori per liberalizzare alcuni settori, per avvantaggio dei cittadini e dei consumatori. Ma questo non è assolutamente incompatibile con una sana politica keynesiana, sana e moderna politica di investimenti pubblici in funzione anticiclica. Dopodiché prenderò un'ultima domanda, vi chiedo scusa, io resterei con voi per moltissimi mesi ancora, ma ho un appuntamento successivo e poi devo andare a prendere l'aereo, quindi. Però io mi prenoto, se mi fa piacere, di tornare qui per un'altra discussione, tra 4-5 mesi, vediamo.
So, to answer the last question that we had in that bunch, which, if I understood correctly, had to do with the fact that some European countries have not have some structural weaknesses and have not done the reforms that they should have done. It's not entirely true to say that the countries of Southern Europe have not undertaken reforms. I mean, even Italy has undertaken some reforms. Okay, not wholly, but we have started. And other countries that are benefiting from the rescue packages are obligated to carry out reforms. So you can't say that the saints are all in the north and the sinners are all in the south, because this is a completely false Manichaean vision of things, and it's entirely untrue. It's true that more must be done in the sense of reforms, but it's equally true that structural reforms alone will not solve the problems, will not solve the economy crisis, it will not solve the competitiveness crisis, and they will not solve the cohesion crisis. So just thinking that reforms alone can be a panacea for all these issues is dangerous, in my view. And so should we discuss what to do to harmonize a bit more the rules of the labor market? Sure, let's talk about it. But increased flexibility is a good thing, but it mustn't lead to too much increase in precariousness, because flexibility mustn't mean precariousness. And I think also that some sectors in the economy should be liberalized to the advantage of consumers and citizens, sure. But we have to put in a framework that is a healthy Keynesian model. So investing public monies where we should, in a healthy and supervised way, and in an anti-cyclical way we should use public money. And I will take one more question, because even though I would love to stay with you for months and discuss things, I have another engagement and then I have a plane to catch. So perhaps I could come back in 4 or 5 months and we could resume this discussion, if you agree.
Well, thank you very much. And we will need to have a very quick last question. I'm sorry, so the lady behind you has been trying to catch my eye from the beginning. So if I may, lady, thank you very much. And then we'll bring the conversation to a close.
I'm Qi Xuancheng, is a visiting scholar from Seika Center. You mentioned the economic common policy and political union are very important for continued development of EU. If a physical union were built in the future, it means member country of the Eurozone couldn't use monetary policy and fiscal policy to adjust the economic situation. If fiscal union, just as this kind of situation, when member country face a symmetry shock, is hard to deal with. Another question is about the political union, how to improve the efficiency of policy decision. Thank you.
Non ho capito bene la domanda. domanda.
Sorry, could you just repeat just the key, the central question?
There were two questions.
Sorry.
Could I ask two questions?
Well, no, because unfortunately we only have time
for only one question.
Your preferred question.
Okay, as for physical union, if the physical union were built in the future, is member country of the Eurozone could use monetary policy and the physical policy to adjust economic situation. When the member country face a symmetry shock, is how to deal with. For example, is as for Italian.
Okay, I think. I think that.
It's related to economic. But it's related as a region policy. I think it's not only it's economic. Okay. Thank you.
Vabbè, non so se ho capito bene, però rispondo a quello che ho capito io. Spero di essere la risposta sia ben accetta. Allora, è chiaro che nel momento in cui oggi no, le politiche monetarie non le possono fare i singoli stati. Quelli che appartengono all'Eurozona ovviamente sono privati del potere di fare politiche monetarie. La mia proposta è che anche le politiche fiscali le faccia l'entità europea e che quindi il potere sulla politica fiscale non sia più degli stati membri, sia dell'entità europea.
Well, I hope I've understood your question correctly, so my answer is to the question that I've understood it. Already single member states cannot devise their own monetary policies if they belong to the Eurozone. Okay? And so the idea of having a fiscal union as well is that the same would be true for fiscal policy, that there would be a central European entity that oversees what the fiscal policies should be.
Attualmente le crisi sono state gestite attraverso il Fondo Salva Stati. È stato creato un Fondo Salva Stati che è intervenuto in alcuni casi insieme al Fondo Monetario Internazionale e alla Banca Centrale Europea per dare un sollievo a quei paesi che erano maggiormente in difficoltà.
Currently, when a member state gets hit particularly hard by a shock, the rescue comes in the form of a rescue fund that has been set up. And sometimes this is used in conjunction with a bailout package furnished by the IMF and the European Central Bank.
La prospettiva è creare un fondo monetario europeo e contemporaneamente da trasformare la Banca Centrale Europea in una prestatrice di ultima istanza e capace di prevenire la crisi del debito sovrano. Questa è la prospettiva a cui noi dobbiamo tendere.
So the goal that we should all work towards would be to create a European Central Bank that works a lot more like the Fed, that could be the lender of last resort and would also be capable of preventing these crises of sovereign debt.
Bene, allora io vi ringrazio moltissimo per la vostra partecipazione che è stata notevole ed è stata anche molto ricca e stimolante per me. Sono veramente felice di aver avuto queste giornate di discussione, di confronto qui a Washington. Porto in Italia almeno tre grandi convinzioni, in Italia e in Europa. La prima grande convinzione è che c'è bisogno di una politica comune transatlantica per la crescita e che anche dagli USA arriva una forte sollecitazione a rimuovere una politica di austerità cieca e sorda. La seconda cosa che porto con me è che vi è una comune necessità di regolamentare in maniera rigorosa e severa i mercati finanziari, soprattutto quel sistema finanziario opaco che è all'origine delle nostre difficoltà odierne. E la terza convinzione che porto con me è che bisogna lavorare in maniera intelligente, ma in maniera tenace e determinata sull'accordo di partnership per la creazione dell'area di libero scambio e per una maggiore integrazione commerciale. Queste sono le tre cose che porto con me. Vi ringrazio molto, spero di poter avere in questo illustrissimo think tank che mi ha ospitato nuove occasioni per confrontarmi con voi sui temi dell'Europa, degli Stati Uniti e del mondo.
Well, thank you very much for your very active participation, which I found most interesting, and I'm going to bring back a lot of ideas from it. I really think that these days in Washington have been very fruitful, and I shall go back to Italy and Europe with a lot of conclusions, but three main ones that I'd like to share with you. First of all, that we need a transatlantic common policy to sustain growth. And I've seen that even in the US, they have been asking Europe to stop this blind and deaf austerity policy because it doesn't work. The second conclusion that I'm taking back with me is that we need a strict regulation for the financial markets, and then we need a strict implementation of such a strict regulation, especially given that this was the problem that gave rise to the crisis and the problems that we're facing today. And the third consideration is that we should work in an intelligent and determined fashion to come up with a true transatlantic free trade area agreement that would boost the trade integration between the two sides of the pond. And I thank again this most illustrious think tank for having me, and I really hope that we will have new opportunities to widen our dialogue.
Thank you very much.
Vice
President Pittella has outlined an ambitious set of political and economic reforms to overcome the Eurozone crisis, and we will be watching with great interest whether the increasing recognitions amongst European politicians that the focus on austerity might have been excessive will create the political space for the European Parliament to move forward with his agenda at the 2014 elections. And in the meantime, all that is left to me is to thank you very much for your questions and ask you to join me in thanking Vice President Pittella. Thank you very much. We would indeed love to host you again. Grazie mille.